we were backpacking during our university years, and we arrived in the big central square in Marrakesh, and there were these vendors with these machines that they would manually juice the oranges, and then you were served a glass of orange juice. That was the first time, and I will always remember that because it was such an unfamiliar and delicious experience.
We're getting fruity on today's show, literally. All three books we're discussing have fruit on their covers. What's inside isn't always so sweet. The first is Oranges, John McPhee's classic investigation of Florida's citrus industry. The second is John Lanchester's The Debt to Pleasure, a wickedly funny story of a plotting gourmand. And the third is Eating to Extinction, written by today's guest, the journalist Dan Saladino, a survey of the world's disappearing foods and a plea to save them.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. President Trump says he's identified funds to ensure the active military gets paid this week. The government shutdown meant U.S. soldiers were at risk to miss their paychecks on Wednesday. NPR's Luke Garrett reports.
The Pentagon says soldiers will be paid this week. The department says it found approximately $8 billion in unused research and development funds from last year. A source not authorized to speak publicly says these funds will pay U.S. troops if the government doesn't reopen by October 15th. The recently identified funds would likely only cover military paychecks this week, leaving future soldier pay uncertain. Democrats and Republicans in Congress remain at loggerheads over government funding. Some lawmakers have proposed a standalone bill that would pay the troops, but Republican leadership insists on a GOP-backed short-term funding bill as the only way forward. Luke Garrett, NPR News, Washington.
The ceasefire between Israel and Hamas in Gaza is now in its third day. President Trump heads to the region later today. He's to speak to the Knesset, Israel's parliament, and to meet with families of the hostages. The hostages are expected to be released by midday tomorrow. About 200 U.S. troops are in Israel to help support the ceasefire. Vice President J.D. Vance said they will not go into Gaza.
Indonesia and a number of other majority Muslim states, they've actually offered to send ground troops to Gaza to ensure the necessary peacekeeping takes place. That's not something the United States is going to be expected to do. That's something the Muslim world is going to step up and do.
Vance was interviewed on ABC's This Week. Death rates have been declining across the globe, but not for adolescents and young adults in some parts of the world. That's according to the latest findings of an international study called The Global Burden of Disease. As NPR's Ritu Chatterjee reports, the study finds a troubling rise in deaths in younger age groups in North America.
There are two age groups that are dying younger in recent years in North America. Christopher Murray is director of the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington and the lead scientist of the new study.
In the sort of 5 to 19 range, we're seeing death rates go up after long periods of decline. So that's very unusual.
The main drivers are gun violence, road injuries, and suicide. The other age group that saw deaths rise in North America is 25 to 39-year-olds, driven primarily by drug overdoses. The study, which also found a rise in depression and anxiety in youth, is published in The Lancet. Ritu Chatterjee, NPR News.
The president of Madagascar issued a statement today that an attempted coup is underway in his country. He did not provide details. Anti-government protests led by young people began last month. Yesterday, some members of the armed forces joined the protests. This is NPR News in Washington. Violence erupted along the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan overnight. Afghanistan says it killed 58 Pakistani soldiers who had violated Afghan territory. Pakistan says 23 troops were killed. Both sides say they destroyed border posts of the other. China and the Philippines are blaming each other for a confrontation in the South China Sea today. The Philippines says a Chinese Coast Guard ship used a water cannon and rammed a Philippine government vessel. China says Philippine vessels illegally entered Chinese waters. The teams are now set for the next round of Major League Baseball playoffs after the Milwaukee Brewers defeated the Chicago Cubs last night in the remaining National League Division Series. Chuck Hornbach has more from Milwaukee.
The Brewers held off the Cubs by a score of 3-1, winning the team's Division Series 3-2. Brewers manager Pat Murphy says he's grateful to lead a club that he says has been underestimated.
They've been doubted all year. Everyone. Yeah, there's nobody predicting the Brewers playing the Dodgers in the series.
Milwaukee begins playing the Los Angeles Dodgers in the National League Championship Series Monday night. The American League Championship Series gets underway Sunday evening with the Seattle Mariners taking on the Toronto Blue Jays. For NPR News, I'm Chuck Kornbach in Milwaukee.
Jacob Kiplimo of Uganda won the Chicago Marathon this morning, finishing ahead of the other men in 2 hours, 2 minutes, and 23 seconds. He's a world record holder in the half marathon. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
We were backpacking during our university years, and we arrived in the big central square in Marrakesh, and there were these vendors with these machines that they would manually juice the oranges, and then you were served a glass of orange juice. That was the first time, and I will always remember that because it was such an unfamiliar and delicious experience.
Hello and welcome to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hepburn. Hello. On this episode of Shelf Life, it's all about food, food, glorious, sometimes not so glorious food. We step into the world of a sinister gourmand in John Lanchester's novel of 90s hedonism, The Debt to Pleasure, take a trip to Florida's orange groves in the genial company of John McPhee, and globetrot with our guest, the veteran BBC food journalist Dan Saladino, author of Eating to Extinction, a timely and endlessly fascinating study of some of the world's rarest foods and why we need to save them. A recipient of a James Beard Award, Saladino has spent the last 2 decades tracking down indigenous and ancient foods that are on the brink of extinction, often hanging on with the help of a few dedicated farmers. Food shows us where real power lies, he writes. It can explain conflicts and wars, showcase human creativity and invention, account for the rise and fall of empires, and expose the causes and consequences of disasters. Food stories are perhaps the most important stories of all. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Wonderful to be here.
Dan, in both of your book choices today, there's a kind of Proustian Madeleine. For John McPhee, it's the orange juice that he recalls as a student traveling around Florida as an undergraduate, subsisting, as he writes, for the better part of 10 days on roadside orange juice, several bags of tangerines, and 3 bushels of late oranges of Valencia. For the sinister and comic anti-hero of John Lanchester's The Debt to Pleasure, an Irish stew made by his nanny, the ill-fated Mary Teresa, is the sort of Madeleine. I wonder if there's a Madeleine memory of your own.
Well, I have many, but if I had to choose one, it has to be a food from Sicily. And one in particular I love because it's so simple. It's called panelli. It's chickpea flour shaped into these rectangles. This is how you find them sold as street food in Sicily. They're deep fried. They're crispy, delicious, salty. And you can have them in buns as well. Pane panelli. And that, when I bite into them, transports me to evenings walking by the sea in a place called Seca Grande with my cousins, and it could be midnight and just walking up and down and talking, and a simple food and the most simple of pleasures.
Amazing, right? The way that food can just transport you. That sort of idea of chasing a food, trying to rediscover that taste of something that is sort of a ghost of our childhood. I spent a long time living in Brooklyn, just around the corner from 100-plus-year-old Sicilian restaurant. It's still there, but Pinelli is on the menu there. So I've had the pleasure of that wonderful street food, but it's hard to find in upstate New York where I am presently.
Very easy to make at home. We'll get on to recipe books in a moment, or a recipe book of sorts in a moment. But I think Pinelli is one that I would recommend all of your listeners try. Delicious, very easy, very hard to make a mistake with Pinelli.
Well, I'm going to be coming back to you for that recipe. But I want to talk about one of the two books you've chosen for today's show, which is Oranges, John McPhee's 1966 150-page study of Florida's orange industry. It's a classic of McPhee's style, full of endlessly riveting anecdotes, facts, digressions, lots of his own delightful encounters. I love the origin story of this book, though, which was one of the first he wrote. And he's got a lovely preface in which he describes seeing an ad in a magazine paid for by the Florida Citrus Association that pictured four oranges, a Hamlin, a Parson Brown, the Washington Naval Orange, and the late Orange of Valencia. And he was freelancing for the New Yorker at the time, looking for ideas for the legendary editor, William Shawn. This is what he writes in the introduction. While mentioning a number of story possibilities to Mr. Shawn, I uttered the single word, "Oranges?" He always answered quickly. It seemed impossible to propose any subject to him that he had not thought about before you had. "No, I'm very sorry. No," he would say typically, his voice so light it felt like mist. "To my question about oranges, though," he said, "yes. Oh my, yes." I loved that story, not only because wouldn't it be wonderful if it was always that simple, but two, because the origin story of Eating to Extinction, your book, is not hugely dissimilar, if I remember. I newly arrived at the Radio 4 show, The Food Program, you pitched a report on the orange harvest in Ribera in Sicily.
Yeah, the lives of the two books, I'm at this point, I must say I'm no John McPhee, but the lives of the two books do weave together in interesting ways. But yeah, it was 2007. It was my first opportunity to make an edition of the Food Program, which had been running for more than 30 years at that point. It was a rare opportunity because I was allowed to travel, and I went to Sicily, where my father had been born and had grown up, and I knew that there was a story to be told around the harvest of citrus. I knew Ribera, the town in the southwest where my father grew up. It was in fact called the City of Oranges, Città dell'Arancia. So important was the orange to that town. And then I travelled eastward to Etna and around the volcano. That's where the blood oranges are being grown. And I met a handful of farmers who were telling me it was the last harvest that year because it no longer made any sense for them to harvest their fruit because of this cheaper citrus that was coming in from Spain and parts of North Africa. I was clearly surprised to hear this story of 1,000 years of fruit growing on small-scale farms and huge amounts of diversity, in some cases, was coming to an end. Citrus represented landscape, culture, identity, flavours, you know, an economy. And so in that story, I was also introduced to a catalogue that the farmers wanted to place their endangered oranges onto, which was called the Ark of Taste, created by Slow Food in the 1990s. And it quite simply is an online catalogue of the world's most endangered foods. There are more than 5,500 now from 130 countries. And I spent over a decade since making that programme tracking down as many of those endangered foods as I can, either for radio programmes or, in the case of Eating to Extinction, an attempt to understand why so many of these foods were becoming endangered in so many different parts of the world. And in writing the book, which I started in 2018, I was able to join the dots and figure out what was the connection between a blood orange being grown in Sicily becoming endangered and a type of maize that had been grown in Oaxaca, southern Mexico.
One of your observations in Ribera is that in response to global demand for two types of oranges, the Naval and the Valencia, farmers in Sicily turned over their groves to those varieties because they naturally assumed that they would have better luck selling them on the global market. But at that moment, instead of having your own variety that is unique to this tiny corner of the globe, you now have an orange that's being grown in South Africa and in Morocco and in the United States. you end up just producing the same thing that everyone else is producing, and then you're competing for them on cost, and you're competing for them in efficiencies and all these other things, and it no longer becomes a craft. It becomes an industry.
And I think that's exactly what McPhee was capturing in the 60s and revealing to his readers as well, that this really was a serious industry on this incredible scale. And so you do hear about the volume of production in the States compared to, you know, what's happening in Europe, and also the reduction in the diversity. So McPhee is wonderful at giving us lists. He turns it into an art form, and a list can become a narrative. But one of the central themes is how successful Florida has been at growing particular types of oranges and then processing them. And it's fascinating to read McPhee during the 1960s, looking at the American citrus industry and then imagining what was unfolding in this Mediterranean island, which had 1,000 years of citrus history. And you could see the future, all the factors were in place for things to become extremely challenging and difficult for those very small scale Sicilian farmers.
You're listening to Shelf Life with me, Aaron Hicklin, and my guest today, the journalist and writer, Dan Saladino. Dan, I read on your Twitter feed that you marked the US publication of your book, Eating to Extinction, with a glass of Perry. Now, you describe Perry in your book as the champagne of England, a cousin to cider that is made with pears. And there's a delightful story of meeting one of the last remaining Perry makers in England, who takes you to a pear tree that he suggests should be considered a living monument, like Stonehenge. Why was that tree so special?
Well, it's called a kopi. That's the type of peri pear tree it is. And the cider and peri maker I was with, Tom Oliver, had spent many years in search of these magnificent trees. And in the case of the kopi, it was 30 feet tall and 30 feet wide at least. And each peri pear tree can live for hundreds of years and produce such distinctive fruits as well, which you wouldn't want to bite into as a table fruit, but actually make these delicious drinks. The kopi that you mentioned is thought to have been extinct. Tom found the last remaining one, and it probably, he says, is the most important moment in his, at least professional life, stumbling across this thought to be extinct tree. And he's now grafted it so that there are now more kopi trees and more peri that can be made from the kopi. And most importantly, as well as capturing so much history, it's a delicious tasting peri. Tom describes it as being like the flavours of a sweet shop, so and chewy. So he says that the sign of a good peri is it makes you want to chew, and the kopi does that.
It's fascinating to me that we spend so much time thinking of heritage in terms of civilization, or at least in terms of the structures we've created. You know, heritage might be a cathedral, or indeed Stonehenge, or other great monuments. But the impression I get so often in reading Eating to Extinction is that the heritage that we tend to overlook, ignore, or not see is often right in front of our eyes. It's things like that pear tree, the kopi. It's things like an orange tree in California that you write about in your book, which is the last remaining tree of two that were originally planted, of these navel orange trees. And that variety of orange is now under serious assault from a virus, an orange pandemic, as it were. So the tree is now surrounded in perspex. But of course, we could have been doing so much more to sort of safeguard species diversity and this heritage all along. I wonder, reading this book, which is so full of stories of crops, fruits, fish that are on the verge of extinction or being reduced to one variety, are we too late?
Well, I have to believe, and this is why I wrote the book, I have to believe that it's not too late. And you're right that I explore foods around the world that are on the brink of extinction. There's 34 in the book. And yeah, in many cases, some of these foods even have gone extinct. But each chapter is also full of heroes, people who have been out there saving these foods, people who are out there right now, but also people who were traveling the world more than a century ago collecting seeds because they understood that diversity was disappearing, and also diversity was something important for all of us and for our future. So I remain optimistic. There are many of the genetic resources that are saved in seed banks and seed vaults. That isn't enough, because we also need farmers to be saving and nurturing this diversity. What really does worry me, though, is the skills and the knowledge that have disappeared. And there are stories of just a handful of people possessing certain skills now. One is the Hadza hunter-gatherers, who are able to have a conversation with a bird that can lead them to bees' nests and honey. That conversation could have been happening for more than 700,000 years. But now just a couple of hundred people are able to have that conversation. It could have been something so fundamental in our development as a species. And yet in our lifetimes, that knowledge, that skill, that awareness could disappear.
Dan, I think you have a section of Oranges by John McPhee to read. Let's get a flavour of this short but influential book.
Well, I think it's an important book because it opens the door that, almost 50 years later, I walk through and write Eating to Extinction. Because the ability to take a seemingly simple story of an orange, it then transports you into a world in which everything is there to discover. Global history, botany, stories of workers and labourers. There's the insights into an industry and the politics of the citrus business. And it's just a brilliantly written, so concise that every single sentence matters. There is no wastage in John McPhee's writing. In the first four or five pages, you are bombarded in such an elegant way with information about different types of oranges and the way in which different people and different cultures around the world consume oranges. I was gripped when I started reading this. And I should explain how I came to know about this book. I came to this book quite late. It was early 2018. And it's when I was having a conversation about Eating to Extinction with my editor at Jonathan Cape. And she said, well, yeah, the storytelling you're describing is making me think of John McPhee and Oranges. Have you read it? And I said, no. And I read it and I was blown away. And I think many others have been as well. If you read Mark Kalansky, for example, Salt and Cod, or Michael Pollan's Botany of Desire, where he tells the story of apples and other plants as well. McPhee was there first, really, in taking an ingredient or a food and showing you the world. So I do want to read a section which is in the second chapter, this story of orange men. So he's taking you into this world of people whose lives and livelihoods revolve around the orange. And again, we've mentioned this already, that he arrives on his research trip, not only quenches thirst, but also, you know, warm his soul with this memory of fresh orange juice as he remembers it as a student years ago. But he's disappointed. And so if I just read why that is. After leaving Interstate 75, I noticed a sign on a roadside eating place that had originally said fresh orange juice. The word fresh had been painted over with white paint, but was still showing through. I dropped in briefly at the Florida Citrus Commission in Lakeland and was invited to have a cup of orange juice, which came out of a dispenser in the front lobby. It was concentrate. While I was there, I heard the story of the day they first demonstrated the fresh juice machine that was used in the Florida Pavilion at the 1964-65 New York World's Fair. The thing was set up in the Citrus Commission lobby, filled with fresh oranges and switched on as it began to split the oranges and squeeze out pitcher after pitcher full of fresh orange juice. Word spread through the building, and employees of the Citrus Commission poured out of their offices and into the lobby, where they drank every drop the machine produced. The next day, the machine was crated and sent to New York. People at the Citrus Commission were still talking about it more than a year later, and probably they still are. Drinking that juice was a real novelty, one man told me. It was a real party. Everyone was smiling. In Winter Haven, which is where he's travelling, which is on the ridge and about equidistant from either end, I took a room in a motel on the edge of an orange grove. Next door was a restaurant with orange trees full of fruit spreading over its parking lot. I went in for dinner, and since I would be staying for some time, and this was the only restaurant in the neighbourhood, I checked on the possibility of fresh juice for breakfast. There were never any requests for fresh orange juice, the waitress explained, apparently unmindful of the one that had just been made. Fresh is either too sour or too watery or too something, she said. Frozen is the same every day. People want to know what they're getting. She seemed to know her business. And I began to sense what turned out to be the truth, that I might as well stop asking for fresh orange juice because few restaurants in Florida serve it. At the next table was a couple who overheard my exchange with the waitress and started a conversation with me. They told me that they lived in Plant City, a town about 20 miles away, and that they had an orange grove on their property with three kinds of oranges, so that ripe fruit was on their trees almost 8 months of the year. All year long, they said, they drank concentrate at breakfast. They hadn't made juice from the fruit of their trees for more than 10 years. After dinner, I drove downtown, and in a hardware store, I found a plastic orange reamer on a bottom shelf. I bought a knife too and went back to the place on the edge of the orange grove. I picked several oranges, squeezed them, and poured the juice into a tall glass. I had what I wanted, but it had been a long day.
That is, it's wonderful. He is such an eloquent writer. Mm. Dan, when I grew up, we still didn't have fresh orange juice in the United Kingdom. I think I was drinking quash, which is an orange squash. And that was my entire idea of orange juice. That's what I thought orange juice was. I wonder when you first had a glass of orange juice.
I had exactly the same experience growing up in the UK in the 70s. Freshly squeezed orange juice was not something that was possible to find, certainly not in my experience. And even when I went to Sicily, bizarrely, they were big eaters of fresh oranges after a meal around the table, but they didn't drink orange juice. I think that's because of the fact that Coca-Cola and Fanta had done such a great job of getting bottles of soda into Sicily as well. So the first time I experienced freshly squeezed orange juice was in Marrakesh in Morocco when I was traveling with my girlfriend, now wife, and we were backpacking during our university years, and we arrived in the big central square in Marrakesh, and there were these vendors with these machines that they would manually juice the oranges, and then you were served a glass of orange juice. That was the first time, and I will always remember that because it was such an unfamiliar and delicious experience.
You're listening to Shelf Life with me, Aaron Hicklin, and my guest today is the author and journalist Dan Saladino. One of the reasons given for the preference for concentrate over fresh squeezed orange juice is consistency. Everyone wants something consistent. John McPhee is traveling around these little gas stations and diners, and everywhere he goes, instead of being given a glass of fresh squeezed orange juice, he's given a glass of orange concentrate.
Yeah, as you say, his Proustian moment really is thinking back to being a student, all this fresh orange juice that he was enjoying while he was there. And he imagines being a traveller arriving in Burgundy and about to sip the finest wines, but how elusive this fresh orange juice has become.
I'm wondering now, as you talk, would it behove us to treat a fruit like the orange, or any fruit, any vegetable, the way we do treat wines, the care and attention that the wine industry pays to provenance and preserving the integrity of each distinct varietal? Maybe that is a sort of roadmap to how we might want to think about other types of produce.
Mm-hmm. In the Victorian era, it was possible to eat a different apple every day in England for 4 years without eating the same apple twice. Not only did that diversity exist, but people really appreciated it. And there were people who were writing about apples the way wine writers write about wine today. And to go from that level of diversity and also appreciation of diversity to just a handful in supermarkets that are also part of breeding programs where they become extremely similar with the same characteristics. I do think we should be thinking about food in the same way as people describe wines, because the reason why that's possible is because of the grape varieties and also the different, you know, ways in which a winemaker will make that wine, and also the terroir, the climatic conditions, the altitude. That isn't exclusive to grapes and wine. It can be applied to tea, coffee, cheese, potatoes. So again, that diversity is of importance. It gives us resilience from diseases and unpredictable conditions. It gives us options. But also, how boring is the world going to become if fashion, language, cinema, and now food becomes so familiar wherever you arrive in the world that you can access the same things and enjoy the so-called same diversity? What I wanted to do was tell thousands of years of human history and stories of different cultures in which that diversity came to be, that it was a combination of genetics, of plants and animal breeds, of ecosystems, so environmental conditions, and cultural preference as well. And that gave us, you know, more than 200,000 different types of wheat that are stored in Svalbard, the seed vault in the Arctic Circle, whereas a farmer today might have an option of growing fewer than 10.
Of course, the poster child for monoculture when it comes to fruit is the banana. You have a fascinating chapter in which you go to Uganda and sort of track down a rare banana there. I think they even use it to make beer. Tell us a little about that experience.
The banana itself, the origin story lies in Asia, and Papua New Guinea, for example, is considered to be a center of diversity. A few thousand years ago, it's thought that there was a second domestication event in East Africa. And so the banana arrived and then spread, and people were growing it in different places and created another wave of diversity. And today we think there are more than 1,500 different varieties of banana. Bizarrely, most of their genetics are stored away in Belgium, which is the center of research. So in Uganda itself, there's around 50 or 60 different varieties of bananas that are used for many different purposes. A lot of them are cooking bananas and the main source of carbohydrate. Some of them are dessert bananas, but there is also the matoke, which is used in beer making. And when somebody proposes marriage, the families come together and the future groom will have brewed some of this banana beer. The symbolism is important because so much effort has gone into making this banana beer that by offering the banana beer to your future family, it's a sign that you are a serious person, that you are hardworking and of good intent. But we are seeing not only a decline in banana diversity around the world because of the rise of the highly successful, for now anyway, Cavendish banana, but this is also impacting on farmers in Uganda. You know, many of those varieties that they've prized and are part of their culinary traditions and cultural practices are disappearing. And so I wanted to tell that story, but also to try and drive home this idea that diversity isn't simply a luxury and a source of pleasure. The Cavendish is under attack from Panama disease, or tropical race 4, as it's known to a lot of scientists. And it's effectively a clone. Once this fungal disease hits one banana plant, it can spread through a monoculture and render the soil in that part of the world. It's no longer possible to grow the Cavendish banana.
I'm Aaron Hicklin. This is Shelf Life, and I'm talking with Dan Saladino about two of his favorite books. Dan, bringing things back often seems to fall on the shoulders of a few dedicated individuals, and it's something that I was struck by again and again reading Eating to Extinction. There's a wonderful story of a pea that came across the Atlantic during the slave trade in the pockets of slaves, and found its way to an island in Georgia. It sort of fell into decline in the 20th century, but it's now back thanks to the efforts of one or two people. Can you tell me a little about that story?
Yeah, and it's a really important story in the history of me writing Eating to Extinction as well, because I had my own personal insights of, you know, endangered foods and the experience in Sicily, but I went to a big event in Turin where farmers, cooks, activists gather to celebrate diversity and share their stories. And there I met a farmer from Georgia, Matthew Rayford, and he remembers stories being told of how his enslaved great-great-great-great-grandparents, going back many, many generations, had been farmers and eventually had handed down these peas, these cow peas. They're red in colour, these peas. And Matthew Rafer told me this story of his efforts to bring this pea back to parts of Georgia. And he visited Sapelo, one of the sea islands on the coast along Georgia, where, again, just a tiny handful of people were saving this pea. But what the most important thing for me was that he told me centuries of history through this pea of people being enslaved in West Africa, of going on these horrific voyages to the American South. Those who survived ended up working as labourers, either, you know, growing rice or other crops. They had their secret gardens where they would often grow ingredients that had come from West Africa and had saved genetic diversity in that way, and also their identity and their food culture. But it was also a valuable pea because it in a rotation of different crops, it could add fertility to the soil, and which meant that it became a really familiar ingredient in the American South, and dishes such as hoppin' john and Reezy Peasy, and that combination of peas and rice, centuries of history captured in the tiniest of ingredients.
Well, for anyone who is interested, that section is up on grandjournal.net. You can read the whole story there. Dan, it's not always about delicious dishes like Hopping John. You also get to eat fermented, rotting mutton on the island of Faro. Why is it important to preserve a food that sounds on the surface of it really quite unpalatable?
It's described by some as somewhere between the taste of Parmesan and death, whatever death tastes like. it's a process of taking mutton, so quite an old sheep, hanging it up in a hut for months. The hut has gaps in the wall which allow the salty sea air from the North Atlantic in. It bathes the leg of mutton, and slowly it's a process of controlled rotting, or as we now describe it, fermentation. And so it kind of cures the meat, preserves it. Why does it matter? Well, firstly, the people who settled on the Faroe Islands, and it's a harsh, remote place, no trees, so you can't burn wood to boil water, to make salt, to preserve food that way. So how do you get through the winter? Well, they ingeniously created the conditions for the island to do that for them, and the environment around them to be able to preserve the meat. And there's pasture, so sheep were very happy on the Faroe Islands, but you needed ways in which you could store the food. Survival stories really matter because they show how ingenious humans have been over time in finding ways of surviving. And I also think it's, again, this coming together of landscape, of a food, of knowledge in a specific location in the world. The Faroe Islands has the conditions to ferment that mutton. If I tried to do it here, it would just end up being an awful mess of rotting meat. So again, it just tells a story of a specific part of the world. However, I think there's a deeper story here as well, which is about the reverence the farmers have for that meat and that process. Obviously, there is a huge debate underway about the future of animal protein and how much meat or what kind of meat should we be eating. But I was standing in this dark hut being served a very thin slice of this cured meat, which I thought was actually delicious, a bit funky. But actually in the context and in that place, it tasted delicious. But there was complete and utter reverence for that source of protein in the animal that had given its life for others to survive.
I imagine there aren't too many vegetarians on the Faroe Islands.
I think they have potatoes. So I think potatoes have been there for a few centuries, but they don't grow that easily. Again, it just explains why is it that food exists in that place? Why is it that people have certain diets? Why did that particular food culture exist? If you had the sheep, there was the pasture, you had your hut, and you could survive in the middle of the North Atlantic through that technique.
You're listening to Shelf Life with me, Aaron Hicklin, and my guest, Dan Saladino. We'll be back after this.
Our Double Down on Radio Catskill party is happening this afternoon at the Arnold House, kicking off our fall fun drive in person with music by DJ Tika Masala, fun activities for kids and adults, free snacks, cash bar. You can support Radio Catskill in our time of need and have fun doing it with a silent auction and chances to win great local prizes. So come on out to the party, 2 to 5 this afternoon at the Arnold House, Livingston Manor.
If you're a history buff, you may want to tune into the next Folk Plus, Sunday at 2 p.m. I'll be playing story songs, all based in events from history, like this one by David Grovitz, about a mining uprising back in 1921 in West Virginia. I hope you'll join me for songs based in history on the next Folk Plus, Sunday at 2, here on Radio Catskill.
Hello, you're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and my guest today is the author and journalist Dan Saladino. Dan, your second book choice is a real curio, a darkly comic murder mystery dressed up as a cookbook by the journalist and novelist John Lanchester. It features a ridiculous and highly unreliable narrator, Tarquin Wincott, who tells the story of his childhood, interspersing it with recipes for various dishes. I'm not sure if those dishes were intended to promote appetite, but I felt about as turned on as I did reading about your experience with rotten mutton in the Faroes. Do you remember the first time you read this book?
I do. And it goes back to the spring 2010. I was making an edition of the food program about restaurant critics. We'd seen this increase in the number of people who were blogging and going online and giving their own reviews. And so I wanted to make a program just saying, well, what is the future of restaurant critics? And as well as a few practicing restaurant critics, I recorded an interview with John Lanchester, who is the author of this book, The Debt to Pleasure. And he came into the studio because he had been originally the restaurant critic at The Observer, and now he was going to be returning as a restaurant critic, this time for The Guardian. And I didn't know John Lanchester's work that well. So one of the things I did was to buy a copy of The Debt to Pleasure and started reading it, and very quickly was laughing out loud. It's such an unusual book, and it's full of surprises, and it tricks you at every turn as well, because it's partly a road trip that goes from the south of England into France. It's partly a cookbook, so it goes into huge detail about menus that he's concocted. We've been talking about John McPhee oranges and eating to extinction. The Debt to Pleasure as a work of fiction is full of so much information and food fact. You could actually use it as a useful reference guide for the origins of all kinds of foods, from cheeses to fruits to different sauces. But at the heart of it is this character who initially reminded me of Uncle Monty in With Nell and I. You can imagine them on a grand tour in Europe in the 18th or 19th century, that they are highly intelligent, very experienced in the ways of food and dining and fine wines, but they are real snobs as well. I don't want to give any spoilers, really, but there's a scene quite near the beginning where our character mentions he's wearing a false moustache. And I won't say too much more, but you're then on high alert to say, what is going on here, as you then enter what is predominantly a story through food.
Yes, as you say, there's the forced moustache. In one scene, he's trying to avoid being spotted by a couple. They're in a French chateau, and he's dressed in what he describes as his regular attire, in a large pattern green and ochre check suit, a pale cerise shirt, a bow tie of yellow polka dots, and a fob watch and chain. So you get a real sense of the sort of comic enormity of this character just from his attire.
It almost makes me think of a Confederacy of Dunces as well. These, you know, larger than life eccentric characters who have a very strong opinion on everyone and everything.
Yeah, this book is often compared to Lolita, at least to the Humbert character in Lolita by Nabokov. But I also thought of Kingsley Amis a lot. I think it was that slightly curdled personality that is a little misanthropic. But I think you have a section here that will give us a flavour of the book.
Before I do that, just to kind of just give you a tiny hint of this character, there's a line here where he says, "I myself have always disliked being called a genius. It is fascinating to notice how quick people have been to intuit this aversion and avoid using the term."
I think you have a passage to read for us, Dan. It's taken from about a third of the way through the book. And our narrator, Tarquin, is talking about an incident with his brother during childhood that gives you a little hint of the kind of sinister undertones of this novel.
And also at the same time, the amount of detail we're given about food.
Yes.
As well. So you said once that peaches remind you of your brother, my biographer remarked to me a while ago. I pretended not to be able to remember. The truth is that the furry fruit does indeed remind me of my sibling, thanks to an unfortunate event that occurred when we were both small. A near fatal case of poisoning that resulted when I, in an early stab at culinary experimentation, prepared a jam made out of peaches and also out of peach stones, the latter containing, it turns out, cyanogen, a stable compound that, when broken down through contact with certain enzymes, or when, for instance, pounded up using a pestle and mortar, produces the celebrated toxin, cyanide. The fruit was literally dropping off the trees that summer near our holiday cottage, falling from branch to ground with a plop that was so visible it was almost audible. And I was unable to resist an attempt at jam making, the basic procedure for the manufacture of preserves having been taught to me by Mithau, who, in the traditional manner of the northern kitchen, was a scholar and aficionado of all forms of preserves, pickles and condiments. My brother's stomach upset, though acute, his fondness for peaches having already been noted, was obviously not fatal, although the médecin, a sombre man with the air of concealed power and sadness belonging to an Angevin duke in bas relief, had a worried 48 hours, as did my mother, no blame attached. For the record, it is not cyanide itself that smells of almonds, as portrayed in what has become a cliché of noir detective cinema, but flesh that has been poisoned by cyanide. A similar toxicity can be achieved with roasted apple seeds.
And of course, the fact that he knows this is very telling. I read some years back an essay by John Lanchester in the London Review of Books, a publication that he writes for frequently. And it was an appreciation of Agatha Christie. And I felt that there might even be a nod to Agatha Christie. There's an ill-fated hamster belonging to Tarquin's brother that dies in mysterious circumstances. And the hamster is called Hercule. There's definitely a nod there to the queen of crime.
And the way it subtly just creeps in a throwaway sentence, it just piques your interest and makes you think that that's an important bit of detail, but I don't know why yet.
There's a lot of that, isn't there, in this book? You're suddenly pulled up short by a little observation or detail that tells you that all is not as it seems on the surface.
And also the playfulness that John Lanchester has in this book with words and descriptions. I read one review where somebody was saying, well, I needed to have a dictionary by my side when I was reading, because it's so playful and wonderful. It's a celebration of words as much as it is with food in that sense. But it does make you think of when it was written in the 90s, that boom in interest in food and restaurants in London. And I think there's a bit of teasing going on here with John Lanchester at people who do overthink food too much. Tarquin is also a recognisable character as well. Somebody who loves food, but perhaps loves it a bit too much or likes to show off their knowledge too much.
Right. It's hard to imagine now this book being written, especially by John Lanchester, who I think of as quite a serious novelist. Not that this is a trifle, but serious in the sense that he tackles climate change and the financial collapse of 2008. But as I was reading this book, I was like, no, it makes absolute sense. It is a journalist's book. He's really observing what was a kind of very blithe era, the 90s, the post-Cold War, pre-9/11 era, when, in fact, restaurants and taking a spin down to the south of France, going through the New Channel Tunnel, all these things were very much part of living in Britain. And so I do actually see it, as much as his other work, as a kind of satire of attitudes at the time. I think it's incredibly clever, but it's not just clever. It's a page turner. You want to get to the end. I mentioned that he's a journalist and writer of nonfiction as well as a novelist. Could you see that influence of his journalism in The Debt to Pleasure?
The economy of words, in that there aren't any sentences that feel like they're throwaway. Yeah, the sense of describing places and characters. Going back to John McPhee as well, that idea of providing you with facts in such an easy, accessible and pleasurable way. So I think it's got that journalistic skill of distilling huge amounts of information in a very efficient way. But again, it's a laugh out loud book, I found.
There's lots of wonderful digressions that also put me in mind of John McPhee's Oranges. You learn all these things almost coincidentally. You know, I was constantly turning to Wikipedia to find out more. There's a story of a snowman that Michelangelo built. Comes out of nowhere, but indeed it turns out that Michelangelo did build a snowman. And there's a section in there too on a French aristocrat fleeing the guillotine in disguise and was given away by asking for an omelette made with 12 eggs, which gave away his ignorance at the number of eggs that would be used in making an omelette. So there's lots of encyclopedic detail hidden away through this book, little Easter eggs for you to find.
Absolutely. It's packed full with those little nuggets of information and detail and references. And I'm just looking now at this reference to cheese. Cheese is philosophically interesting as a food whose qualities depend on the actions of bacteria. It is, as James Joyce remarked, the corpse of milk. Dead milk, live bacteria. A similar process of controlled spoilage is apparent in the process of hanging game, where some degree of rotting helps to make the meat tender and flavoursome. I'm going back to what we were saying about the Faroe Islands and that mutton. Again, it's just somebody who really knows their stuff and playfully, joyfully, in some cases, before it darkens, sharing it with you.
Another moment that put me in mind of your book is when Tarquin is describing salad, the triumph of France and the shame of England. He goes through all the typical salad ingredients one by one, these tasteless tomatoes that are available year round, the red pepper that tastes like plastic. And it did bring me back to eating to extinction. And I wonder how much you thought during these expeditions and journeys you undertook of how important seasonality is, and if that's also partly where we've gone wrong, is trying to create a 12-month season for everything. The memory of many people today in the West certainly is only ever going to be of sort of mass-produced supermarket food. I wonder how easy it is to kind of bring our palates back to where they were before farming of the scale that it's at now kind of reduced everything to tasteless pap.
Well, it's partly why I wanted to tell the story in, again, there are lots of very short chapters and short stories within Eating to Extinction. One of them is a profile of a guy called Isaiah Levy, who used to work for London Underground and was given a type of squash by a colleague who'd grown it in his allotment. And then Isaiah, who was a young man of Jamaican heritage, became obsessed with the flavour of that squash, which he hadn't tasted before. And when he opened it up and cooked it, realised there were seeds inside. So he saved the seeds, started growing them, and then became a seed saver and would grow vegetables wherever he could, in his mum's back garden, in carrier bags filled with soil. And it was an obsession. And then he was so determined that other people could experience this food, he shared the seeds, put them in envelopes to mail them out to whoever he could make contact with, on a mission to save diversity and spread this pleasure and for people to become a little bit more self-sufficient. Sadly, he passed away at a very young age. But his story has inspired many people to think that even in an urban setting of, in his case, South London, it was possible to grow food and to value diversity and take great pleasure in growing your own food.
Dan, talking about seeds, I was moved to tears by the story of the Russian botanist Nikolai Vavilov. I wonder if you could tell a potted version of his tragic story for the listeners.
Nikolai Vavilov was a botanist who wanted to find a way in which famines and hunger could be averted. And he had the vision of thinking that if he could gather as much genetic material as possible, that would give crop breeders the toolkit by which they could improve crops and food for the people. And so he embarked on this tour of the world, collecting seeds in five different continents, a total of 150,000 individual samples he and his colleagues saved. And it then created the biggest seed collection of its time in St. Petersburg. He then falls out of favor with Stalin and the Soviet regime in the late 30s and into the 1940s because of an ideological dispute over science, and he ended up being sent to prison. Meanwhile, during the occupation and the Nazis surrounding St. Petersburg, he had so inspired his colleagues about this seed collection and its importance in the future of the world that a siege that lasted around a year meant that food was running out. And these workers, these seed savers in the Vavilov, what is now the Vavilov Institute, were surrounded by packages of edible seeds and, for example, rice. And some of them starved to death saving these seeds because they believed in the mission that Vavilov had started, that these seeds were so precious for the future of the world, they were too important to consume, even though they were starving. Vavilov himself ended up dying of the very thing he was trying to prevent, which was starvation himself. And it took decades for his reputation to be restored. And now he is a hero to people interested in crop diversity and in the importance of saving seeds. And it was his story that inspired an American botanist, Kerry Fowler, to set up Svalbard, the seed vault in the Arctic, which stores seeds representing our agricultural history as humans.
And that is a very powerful image on which to close on, people putting the future of the world before their own lives. Dan, thank you so much for being my guest today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
And for me as well, Aaron. Thanks very much for inviting me on.
We've been talking about Eating to Extinction by Dan Saladino, which was published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux, and his two favourite books, Oranges by John McPhee, also published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux, and The Debt to Pleasure by John Lanchester, published by Picador Books. You can find this podcast and more like it on all good podcast platforms. And my thanks as always to our producer, Ilya Maritz, and our sound engineer and composer, Tim Wood.
Peace, Love, and Pumpkins at Bethel Woods is back October 10th through November 2nd. The Halloween walkthrough experience features thousands of jack-o'-lanterns and hand-carved pieces of glowing pumpkin art, including dinosaurs, mermaids, witches, and Woodstock festival icons. Featuring special events, including a murder mystery mixer, Friday Night Frights, and drone shows on select dates. Peace, Love, and Pumpkins runs Wednesdays through Sundays through November 2nd. BethelWoodsCenter.org. Paid for by Bethel Woods Center for the Arts.
Radio Catskills Fund Drive is happening now. Give now at WJFFradio.org, because when you donate, you're not just giving money, you're making an investment. You're powering local news, nurturing young talent, and building the connections that make our communities stronger. And now is a great time to give, because we need you now more than ever. Make your donation today at WJFFradio.org.